Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Wells Dixon, an attorney with the Center for Constitutional Rights, who explains why he and many other legal scholars believe that the detainee treatment bill just passed by Congress is unconstitutional. BBC TV investigative journalist Greg Palast lays out the facts which he says support the belief that politics is playing a crucial role in declining gasoline prices in advance of this November's congressional election. And Jack Cole, co-founder and executive director of the group Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, who discusses why increasing numbers of police officers believe that the U.S. drug war has failed and that a new approach must be found. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The fate of the so-called partial birth ban is on the top of the docket for the U.S. Supreme Court as it returned to work on October 2nd. The court will hear a challenge to the new federal law on the grounds it does not seek to protect the life of the mother. In 2000, the Supreme Court overruled a similar state law in Nebraska. Now the High Court has two new conservative members, Chief Justice John Roberts and Justice Samuel Alito, who many court observers believe will vote to uphold the partial birth abortion ban. Pro-choice activists are also leery of what would happen if the Supreme Court overturns the historic 1973 Roe v. Wade ruling legalizing abortion rights. According to the American Prospect magazine, anti-abortion forces are much better organized at the state and local level. In recent years, they have worked successfully to chip away at reproductive rights. For example, Mississippi passed its first restrictive law on abortion in 1986, requiring doctors to get the written consent of both parents before performing an abortion on a minor. More recently, the southern state has adopted 35 pages of regulation for abortion clinics, ranging from the size of the parking lot to the width of the hallways. As a result, five abortion clinics in Mississippi have closed over the last decade. Meanwhile, NARAL Pro-Choice America only has local chapters in 27 states, while the rival National Right to Life Committee has a presence in all 50 states. Overall, NARAL gives 27 states poor or failing grades on reproductive rights, while just 17 states received a good or excellent rating. State lobbyists for anti-choice groups have taken advantage of the 1992 Casey Supreme Court decision that upheld the right to an abortion but allowed for more restrictions. Anti-abortion activists over the last 7 years have passed 437 laws in the states. In comparison, pro-choice activists passed 297 laws in the states on issues ranging from abortion to birth control and abstinence-only sex education. Old industrial towns like Lima, Ohio, are critical to the prospects of progressive Sherrod Brown, the Democratic candidate campaigning to oust GOP Ohio Senator Mike DeWine. Lima, a solid blue-collar city of 40,000 people, is hurting. The community has lost 8,000 manufacturing jobs and a quarter of its population since 1985. Brown, a seven-term congressman from northern Ohio and a stern critic of free trade pacts like NAFTA, is running to be the champion of these industrial workers and creating new high-wage jobs for the region. In the November 7th election, Brown needs to exceed the mediocre tally won by John Kerry in Lima in the 2004 presidential election. As Roger Toss of the Transport Workers Union told The Nation magazine, the Democrats have trouble figuring out how to talk about economics. They don't know how to reach the people who are hurting but still vote Republican. Sherrod Brown refuses to believe that these voters can't be won over. Most polls show the Ohio Senate race is razor tight, so close that Karl Rove has made it a national priority to hold on to the Ohio Senate seat. In speaking to senior citizens, Brown reminds his audience that he organized buses to Canada to buy cheaper medications, while DeWine took $500,000 from the pharmaceutical industry. Brown's populist campaign is also a test for the Democrats in their economic message for 2008. The progressive candidate is making a direct appeal to old-line blue-collar voters and downplaying his appeal to soccer moms, the group sought by Clinton-era Democrats. On September 29th, the Food and Drug Administration called off its two-week recall of bagged spinach, some of which carried a nasty strain of E. coli. One person died during the outbreak, and 188 became ill from eating spinach grown in California's Salinas Valley, known as the nation's salad bowl. This is the ninth lettuce or spinach recall from Salinas Valley, where E. coli is found in local groundwater polluted by area cattle ranches, reports the Los Angeles Times. The FDA traced the outbreak to the Natural Selection Company, a major food processor of vegetables, including a leading organic brand, Earthbound Farm. With the crisis over, David Acheson, chief medical officer of the FDA's Food Safety Division, insisted a similar E. coli outbreak could happen again. As he told reporters in a conference call, until fundamental fixes are in place, there is an obvious concern that 2 months from now we could have the same conversation. According to The Grist, an online environmental magazine, skeptics of organic farming tried to exploit the E. coli outbreak to raise doubts about common organic practices like using manure-based fertilizer. Many environmentalists blame the outbreak on the highly centralized food processing industry in California's Central Valley. In the Salinas Valley, only one river watershed does not violate federal E. coli standards. The river that meets water quality standards flows through a state park and is protected from waste by cattle and other farm animals. Some of the watershed readings in the Salinas area exceed EPA E. coli standards by over 30%. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Bill Cosentino.
In the final weeks before the November 7th midterm congressional election, the Republican-controlled House and Senate passed the Military Commissions Act, legislation that lays out how the U.S. can try terrorist suspects and how detainees are treated under the Geneva Conventions. The GOP, facing a very tough election year, hope their get-tough-on-terrorism rhetoric and passage of this bill would increase their chances to retain control of Congress. The bill, approved in the House by a 253-168 vote margin and in the Senate by a 65-34 vote, gives the President unilateral power to define the meaning and application of the Geneva Conventions while prohibiting the judiciary branch from hearing challenges. The law also expands the definition of unlawful enemy combatant to include those who directly or indirectly support hostilities against the United States. Under the measure, the President has the power to declare U.S. citizens enemy combatants, subject to indefinite detention. Most alarming to civil liberties advocates is the provision of the law that eliminates the U.S. Constitution's habeas corpus protections for non-U.S. citizens, preventing them from challenging their detention in federal court. Shortly after the bill's passage, the Center for Constitutional Rights filed the first challenge to key provisions of the Military Commissions Act. Many observers expect that this and other challenges will eventually be heard by the U.S. Supreme Court. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Wells Dixon, an attorney with the Center for Constitutional Rights, who explains why he and many other legal scholars believe the new law is unconstitutional.
To give you an idea of some of the more troubling provisions, the Act would provide retroactive immunity to military and intelligence officials for detention and interrogation practices that are prohibited by the Detainee Treatment Act. This would include all of the abuses that occurred at Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo. The Act would also retroactively amend the War Crimes Act to avoid prosecutions for all but the most egregious violations of the Geneva Conventions, in particular Common Article 3. And it would grant President Bush the sole discretion to punish other violations like cruel and inhuman and degrading treatment. But perhaps most strikingly, what the Act does is it suspends habeas corpus, and it does so for any alien detained by the United States. Now, this would include lawful immigrants in the United States, and it would really deprive them of any opportunity to challenge the legality of their detention. So, for example, if you have someone with a green card who's picked up on the streets of New Haven, the president would have the authority to hold that person indefinitely without access to any kind of court or any kind of fair hearing. It's very, very troubling.
In other realms, tell us a bit about the types of torture that are specifically outlawed by this legislation and the loophole created for other kinds of mistreatment or torture.
The Act would define torture very, very narrowly. And it would do so in a way that essentially sanctions the very limited definition of torture that you may remember from the John Yoo torture memorandum. This defines torture, and it defines serious physical pain to include the level of pain that might be experienced when a person is close to death or subject to organ failure. So by defining torture so narrowly, what Congress has essentially done is to create a definition that would legalize every interrogation technique that's been used by the Bush administration to date. For example, under this narrow definition of torture, waterboarding, induced hypothermia, and prolonged sleep deprivation would not constitute torture and therefore would not constitute a violation of the Geneva Conventions.
Now, with the Geneva Conventions, what is the history of the United States or any other country defining in their own terms what torture is, and what kind of precedent will this set for other nations around the world?
Well, the Geneva Conventions, as you know, have protected our soldiers since they were enacted more than 50 years ago. And to my knowledge, there have never been instances in which a signatory to those treaties has taken upon itself to define their obligations in such a way that would essentially exempt them from the most basic fundamental provisions of the Geneva Conventions, including but not limited to Common Article 3. This obviously creates a very dangerous precedent because it would invite other nations to do the same thing. In other words, if the United States were, as a matter of law and policy, to say that waterboarding is no longer torture and is not does not constitute a grave breach of the Geneva Conventions, then that would free other countries to employ that technique potentially against our soldiers who were captured abroad, and in doing so to claim that their conduct still conformed with the Geneva Conventions.
When you look at this new Military Commissions Act legislation and the prospects that this could in the near or long-term future be challenged or overturned, I guess there are two vehicles to do that. Number one, the U.S. Supreme Court will undoubtedly review this legislation with challenges that will come its way. And Congress, too. A new Congress, presumably in the hands of the other party, the Democrats, could make changes, could they not?
They could certainly make changes, and we would certainly encourage them to do so. However, I would note that a number of Democrats supported this act, among them Senator Lieberman from Connecticut, which is, of course, very disappointing. The more likely avenue to challenge this, as you mentioned, through the Supreme Court. Senator Specter from Pennsylvania noted last week before the act was passed that it is, quote-unquote, blatantly unconstitutional on its face. And for that reason, we will certainly challenge the law, and we are very confident that we will succeed in that challenge.
Maybe you could review for us the strongest reasons why you believe this law is unconstitutional and will be overturned by the U.S. Supreme Court.
Well, very simply, it's unconstitutional because it doesn't provide any meaningful opportunity for individuals detained by the president to challenge the legality of their detention. Under our system of government, and indeed under any Western legal system, individuals who are detained by the executive have the right under habeas corpus to challenge the factual and legal basis for their detention. The Military Commissions Act provides no avenue for that to occur, and as a result, the act would violate the suspension clause of the U.S. Constitution.
That was Wells Dixon, an attorney with the Center for Constitutional Rights that represents detainees held at the U.S. Naval Base at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. Contact the center by calling area code 212-614-6464 or visit their website at www.ccr-ny.org. Public opinion polls reveal that Americans rank the Iraq War and terrorism as the most important issues facing the nation as the midterm congressional election nears. But the U.S. economy often trumps other concerns, rewarding incumbents when jobs and wages rise and punishing those in power when the economy stagnates or declines. After record-high gasoline prices earlier this year, Republicans hope a recent drop in the cost of fuel will diminish voter anger on at least one extremely negative issue for the GOP, who are campaigning to maintain control of the House of Representatives and U.S. Senate this November. The average price for a gallon of gas around the U.S. is now about $2.35, down from $3 or more this summer. Energy analysts attribute the sharp decline in gas prices to the current oversupply and decreased end of the summer demand. but a recent poll found that many Americans believe that politics and the coming election has played a crucial role in the fall of gas prices. A Gallup poll released the last week of September found that 42% of Americans surveyed agreed with the statement that the Bush administration deliberately manipulated the price of gasoline so that it would decrease before this fall's elections. 53% of those surveyed did not believe the premise. 5% said they had no opinion. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Greg Pallas, BBC TV investigative reporter and author of the new book, Armed Madhouse. Pallas lays out the facts which he says supports the belief that politics is playing an essential role in declining gasoline prices in advance of the November election.
We're supposed to be happy that they've dropped the price of gasoline now to $2.50 a gallon. That's like someone saying, I'm so thrilled my husband's beating me 3 times a week because he used to beat me 6 times a week. Okay? We are getting beaten severely by the oil cartel, both the domestic corporate oil cartel and the OPEC cartel. There is no market in oil. There is only a monopoly in oil, an oligopoly. In fact, the OPEC cartel is an illegal conspiracy, constraint against trade, which somehow our president hasn't noticed because he keeps taking the head of the conspiracy, the capo di capi of the oil price fixers, King Abdullah, around in his golf cart at Crawford Ranch. So what's happened is that when we suddenly see this huge rise in distillates, what's going on is that the U.S. oil industry is suddenly cranking up them old refineries to push more gasoline into the market and bring it down. In other words, you haven't had that big of a price decline at the crude level. You've had this monstrous price decline suddenly in gasoline after a vile, disgusting, gouging price increase in gasoline under the current regime. But they've taken their foot off the pedal for a few months by simply jamming the market by cranking up the refinery. So that's what you see. If you look at the actual numbers, it's this huge push of distillate product by the U.S. refiners.
What's the motive here? Is it political?
They don't have any other motive. I mean, the bottom line is money, and the money has to be protected by politicians. Basically, it's a protection racket. In other words, they're feeding the golden goose that lays the golden eggs, and the way that they have to feed is once in a while they have to drop prices for political reasons. And you have to look at this long history. This isn't the first time we've seen this. In 2002, just before Jeb Bush was facing a very tough re-election fight, the only time until Hurricane Katrina, the only time in the entire first term of President Bush was oil released out of the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, and only to the state of Florida. Only. It's a refined product to the state of Florida. And that was a personal decision of Dick Cheney. Then the only time that the Saudis, twice the Saudis have opened up their spigots, if you read the chapter on oil, the oil industry called Trillion Dollar Babies in our madhouse, 2 times the Saudis have opened up their spigots full blast. Total flat-out production. And one was just before the 2004 election when George Bush needed to get within stealing range of the presidency. And the other was just before the tanks rolled in Iraq, because the promise had been, of course, by Paul Wolfowitz, who was testifying before Congress, that if we go into Iraq, we're going to reduce the price of oil. And, you know, the Wall Street Journal was selling the war in Iraq as, you know, oil is going to be dirt cheap after we invade because we'll grab Iraq by the crude. And then, of course, they immediately cut off production afterwards after the tanks had already rolled and oil went through the roof. So you see this long history of political manipulation by the regime in Washington and the regime in Riyadh and the corporate regime out of Houston.
Do you think the manipulation of that indeed is what's happening here of oil prices is going to work at all to the advantage of the Republicans as we go into the midterm congressional elections? Will the public buy it?
The oil market is always manipulated. There is no such thing as an unmanipulated oil market. It is set there as a cartel which has meetings which sets the price of crude, and then you've got a crew in Houston that determines how much is distilled. So it's always manipulated. The question is, will this particular manipulation, which is that after they choke us to death and then they let up just a little bit, are people going to be that stupid? Are people going to be that completely dumb, say, oh, You know, they didn't. I didn't have to like sell my third child to fill up my Hummer this week. So obviously, you know, that means I've got to vote Republican. Yeah, of course it'll work. I mean, I've put down big money that the Republicans are gonna keep both houses. I don't have any doubt whatsoever. So it's not so much that is there a political manipulation behind the recent decline in prices. We should be talking about the huge increase in prices, which is not because these guys screwed up. It's because that was their program, was in fact to raise oil prices.
That was BBC TV investigative reporter and author Greg Palast. His new book is titled Our Madhouse. Read his articles online at gregpalast.com. This electoral season, the state of Connecticut can offer political junkies more than just the Joe Lieberman-Ned Lamont race for the U.S. Senate. It is also a state where a governor's race includes a Green Party candidate who supports drug legalization. That candidate has opened the door to the efforts of an organization called Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, or LEAP, to promote drug legalization as a national policy. LEAP activists are now crisscrossing the state, hoping to increase the visibility of their cause. LEAP was founded in 2002 by five ex-police officers with 90 years of experience on the front lines of the drug war. The organization believes that the war on drugs is not one monolithic problem, but rather two distinct issues. One is the problem of substance abuse, and the other is the crime and violence associated with the drug marketplace. The group advocates legalization to deal with the crime and violence, that is, to bring marijuana, heroin, and cocaine under legal control, like tobacco and alcohol are already. LEAP members address mainstream civic groups such as Rotary, Lions Club, and Chambers of Commerce, where audience members are often not convinced that drug legalization is the way forward. The following is an excerpt from a conversation between the lines Melinda Tuhus conducted with LEAP co-founder and executive director Jack Cole, a former lieutenant in the New Jersey State Police Department.
When we started the war on drugs, you could count the number of people we arrested before 1970 in the tens of thousands. Then with that 11 times increase in these narcotics units, in 1970 we kicked that up to 415,000 people we were arresting every year for nonviolent drug offenses. And it stayed that way until about 1980. In 1980, we were up to a little over 500,000. But in 1980, a couple interesting things happened. First, the politicians decided they would get into it. They came to us and they say, hey, you cops are doing a great job, but if you just get out there, you'll work a little bit harder, arrest more people. We promise you, we will back you 100%. We'll create the harshest laws that have ever existed. Mandatory minimum sentences, three strikes, you're out law. You'll only have to deal with these people a couple times. He'll go to jail forever. So we said, well, okay, we'll try that. And at the same time, we got a new man in the presidency, Ronald Reagan. Mr. Reagan came to us and said, you guys are on the supply side arresting dealers. And what you should be doing is you should be working on the demand side arresting users. Because if you arrest enough users, you'll frighten them away. And if there aren't any users, there won't be any dealers. So that had a bit of some sort of kind of logic, and we said, well, we'll try anything. You know, this problem has gotten so bad. And you can see the escalation of arrests after that. In 2005, we arrested 1,845,000 people, and 45% of those offenses are for marijuana offenses. And because we were told to arrest users, 88% of the marijuana offenses are for possession. And let me tell you about all these people's lives, 1.8 million lives that we're affecting every year. Every one of those folks, if they're not destroyed, they are certainly crippled. We have a saying at LEAP, you can get over an addiction, you will never get over a conviction. A conviction will track you every day for the rest of your life because it's on a computer. So after you come out from this arrest and possibly imprisonment, you'd go and try to get a job. If you're a young person, you know, it's over your head like this big ugly cloud. people look at that record and say, hey, druggie, we don't want you. As a matter of fact, the only people who want them is right back in that drug culture, the very people we say we're trying to save them from. If we catch a kid with so much as one marijuana cigarette, say in their bedroom, first thing we do in most states is we take their driver's license away. Now, if they live in rural America or suburban America, that means they can no longer get to school. They can no longer be gainfully employed because we don't have public transportation out there. And if they live in the cities where we do have public transportation, but they're poor and happen to live in government-subsidized housing, they don't anymore. Get caught with so much as one marijuana cigarette, not only are you thrown out of your house, but so are your parents. And if you happen to live with your grandparents, because maybe your parents were already taken off and thrown in jail for smoking pot or something, those old folks have to hit the bricks too. And the U.S. Supreme Court ruled 3 years ago, last November, I believe it was, that this kind of mass punishment is okay in this country. It's okay because we're fighting a war on drugs. And when you fight a war, you can justify almost anything. We spend $1 trillion already on the war on drugs in 36 years, and every year we continue it, we'll throw another $69 billion down that same rat hole. And what do we have to show for it? Today, drugs are cheaper, they're more potent, and they're far easier to access by our kids than they were in 1970 when I started buying them undercover. That's a failed policy any way you look at it. This involves going to foreign countries and spraying the crops, you know, with poison, and also spraying those poor campesinos that are growing those things. Of course, we don't worry about that because they're only third world folks anyway. It involves interdicting the drugs, the 90% of drugs that go right through that sieve at our border, arresting those folks, and then the immense costs of prosecuting each one of them, and then the ones that are found guilty and we can put in prison, the cost of housing them for a year in prison at the cost of, on average, $26,000 per person per year.
That was Jack Cole of LEAP, Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. Contact the group by calling area code 781-393-6985 or visit their website at www.leap.cc. You've been listening to Between the Lines, the weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio. 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Bill Cosentino, Chris Ferriero, Hank Hoffman, Denise Manzari, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Ruben Abreu.